thanks a lot, Miriam, for the kind introduction and also for the invitation to give this colloquium. The workshop, which is organized here at the moment very nicely by Miriam, Ralph, and others, indeed has in its title Strings at the LHC, but I believe that it's also appropriate perhaps to discuss this topic in front of a little bit broader audience. So this is what I will do, and I will discuss with you what are the possible prospects or chances. Maybe they are not very high, but at least they exist, to see directly strings at the LHC. So let me assume somehow that by some reason or the other you are interested in string theory and the personal motivation why somebody could be interested in string theory might vary from case to case, but I think nevertheless, then in you should be basically interested in the following question, namely, what is string theory good for? And this question might sound a little bit silly, but I think it is very much discussed during these days. But perhaps we can rephrase this question also in a little bit more concrete terms, namely to ask, where is the typical energy scale of string theory? How much energy do you need to see stringiness of physics, so to say, to excite a string which is a one-dimensional object? And again, here the answer nowadays varies from personal taste to taste. So I give you a short list, and this list is not historical, it's not chronological. So I start with the most recent development, namely, it turned out that string theory could be used for condensed matter systems. So some people regard condensed matter as being strings. This is a topic of the ADS condensed matter correspondence, and if you are following this approach, then the string scale is very tiny, it's very low, it's of the order of 1 eV, and this approach turned out to be, I think, partly successful in describing, for example, high-TC superconductors, which was pioneered by these people about 2 years ago. And Gary Horowitz, who is here, could certainly tell you much more about this. If we raise the energy by 9 orders of magnitude, then we come to hadron theory. So if you believe that hadrons are strings, this is now famous topic of the ADS and CFT correspondence and variants thereof, then the string scale is of the order of the typical hadronic energy scale. It is 1 GeV. And actually, if you go back to history, this is how string theory was invented. It was invented by Veneziano, showing his famous amplitude with these hadrons as stringy resonances, and it was further developed by many people, of course, as you know. But finally, I think one should not give up the hope that elementary particles can be described as strings. And here, of course, the main motivation for doing string theory or for applying string theory to particle physics is still quantum gravity. And for me, this is still the perhaps the most basic or strongest motivation for doing string theory. And as Scherk and Schwarz back to in the year 74 then told us that the string scale, the typical string scale, has to be very, very high. It has to be of the order of the Planck scale, namely 10 to 19 GeV. And if this is so, it is very, of course, very unlikely to be produce strings or string excitations directly in experiments here at zeros. There might be indirect evidence for the stringiness of physics, but of course it is very high to see strings if the energy of the string is 10 to 19 GeV. But actually, as we have seen during the recent years, this is not even necessary. But if you look a little more closely, and I will discuss this, there's a wide range of possibilities where actually the string scale can be. In this range is between 1 TeV roughly, the scale of the LHC, and of course 10 to 19 GeV, the scale where naively quantum gravity sits. Why I'm telling you this, one problem in particle physics is the so-called hierarchy problem. And in fact, without going into much more detail, it is there are many good arguments that the solution of this hierarchy problem hints at new physics at the TeV scale, and that was one of the main motivation to spend this 3 or 4 billion euro into the LHC to build it and to hopefully discover LHC to see new physics in the TeV region. And when I see TeV region, I'm a little bit more crude now. I mean, perhaps even the energy scale of the standard model. But here, and this is now the hierarchy problem, the question, the theoretical question arises, why the scale of LHC or the scale of the standard model is still this 16 orders of magnitudes smaller than the Planck scale. And this is a big energy gap, which should be explained by one reason or the other. One popular way to explain the hierarchy problem, at least in technical terms, why certain constants of nature can be fine-tuned and are stable under fine-tuning, is low-energy supersymmetry. And just give you an estimate what could be the typical string scale in models without going into further details here, where one realizes the low energy supersymmetry in string theory. You take the geometric mean between this scale or the Zuse scale and the Planck scale, and then you arrive already at string scenarios where the string scale is somewhat lower, or not only somewhat, it's much lower than the Planck scale already. The other way to explain this hierarchy problem, and I will discuss it a little bit further during the talk, is indeed to give up the normal assumption that the scale of quantum gravity is at 10 to 19 GeV, but to postulate that quantum gravity effects are already operative at a much lower scale, namely basically at the scale of the standard model, or a little bit higher at the scale of 1 TeV. And if you follow this line, then unavoidably you also have to conclude, as we will see, that the typical string scale, the string you need to excite a string, is also of order of 1 TeV. And both scenarios are indeed possible in string compactifications. And during my talk, I will basically now concentrate on this path. Of course, this is also very interesting, and many people are working how low-energy supersymmetry can be realized in string compactifications. But for today, I now want to concentrate on this direction of the hierarchy problem. So what we are indeed discussing today are low string scale compactification. And just to repeat, I want to suppose that the fundamental scale of gravity, which is to say the string scale, is around 1 TeV, as it is written here. And this now means that at 1 TeV, if we have enough energy, if we have 1 TeV, we already are able to open up all possible string excitations. The string is a one-dimensional object which can vibrate, and to excite its vibrational or even rotational modes, you need a certain amount of energy, which is precisely this string scale. So we have to conclude is a string, if the string scale is so low, then there will be stringy so-called regular excitations at 1 TeV. There's a basic formula which describes the spectrum of this relativistic string. It's basically the spectrum of a harmonic oscillator. So you have these oscillation modes, and the masses of the oscillators are given then in terms of integer numbers n, where n goes from 1 to infinity. And the special thing is, as higher you go in the oscillator number, you also get states with increasing angular momentum. And if you analyze this formula, you will discover the famous ratchet trajectories, that the angular momentum is a function, is a linear function of the mass square of the string excitations, and the various excitation modes follow this kind of linear ratchet trajectories. So then, in a way, the following double string picture arises. If you back up and go to the 1 GeV scale, where there are also good reasons that the hadrons are not really elementary strings, but they are string-like objects. We have the hadrons at 1 GeV, which are possibly described by ADS-CFT, and then we have the elementary strings, elementary open strings, as I will explain. Their zero modes are nothing else than the known elementary particles, as a, being the quarks, the gluons, etc. And then for each elementary particle which we know, there will be excited particles, the string excitations, so excited quarks and gluons and so on at 1 TeV. For example, if we look at the gluon, the spin one color octet of quantum chromodynamics, it will have excitations, also of course being color octets, but with spin 0, 1, and 2 is the lowest energy level, and then so on. Or if you look at all the quarks, they will also have at 1 TeV first excitations, and if you analyze the formula, the first excitation of the quarks will have spin 1 half and spin 3 half, and this pattern will be then true for all the elementary particles. So in a way, we have two kinds of ratchet trajectories which should not be confused. The ones for the hadrons, which are composed out of quarks, and now, if you wish, a nearby new ratchet trajectory for all the elementary particles, like the quark and the gluons themselves. So, how then does string theory meet collider physics? Of course, the idea is very simple and basic. What we are doing, for example, at the LHC, we are looking at the collisions of quark and gluons. QCD, clearly, quantum chromodynamics, is still valid at low energies, but now at higher energies, we will have corrections from string theory due to this new colored object, the excitations of the gluons and quarks themselves. So we clearly expect a new string in physics. It's a collider in case the string scale is of the order of TeV. And what we expect is, of course, to discover these universal heavy string excitations. And here at this very moment, I'd like to emphasize that these higher spin excitations of the known standard model particles, they are really very universal. They do not depend on any compactification scenario. And this will be important for our further analysis, because in a way, we want to make a model independent statements which do not depend on any specific further subtleties of string theory. Okay, so the outline of my talk then is the following. I will be a little bit more specific about mass scales, in particular string models, the so-called deep brain compactifications, and then I will apply this as a test of deep brain models at the LHC. This is a project which we are now following for about 2 years. We call it this LHC String Hunters Companion. It is in collaboration with Stefan Stieberger, Thomas Taylor, Louis Ankodoki, Heim Goldberg, Satoshi Nawata, and Oliver Schlotterer, a student in Munich, and there's a series of papers on this subject. So what kind of basic mass scales we have to face or we have to discuss in these deep brain compactifications. To understand this, I cannot give you now here an introduction into string theory or even into string compactifications and deep brains. So let me just say a very few words. What are the what is the basic setup of this so-called type 2B or type 2A orientifolds, which are the technical terms of deep brain compactifications. So you might know, or most of you know, that string theory is a 10-dimensional theory. It lives in 10 dimensions, so we have to compactify in order to make contact to reality, to low energy phenomenology. So we assume that 10-dimensional space-time is a direct product of flat 4-dimensional space-time R31 times a compact 6-dimensional space M6. So this is the first step. This is called compactification. And then as a second ingredient, we have the so-called deep brains, which are basically nothing else than special planes or surfaces in space-time, which give you additional structure. And the deep brains I will discuss, they are always three-dimensional, so they are always completely embedded in this Minkowski space, and they have some extra dimensions, some extra p dimensions, which wrap some, say, cycles in the space M6. So the basic picture looks like follows. So this is a, if you wish, a sketch of the compactification. This is our internal six-dimensional space, and then you have these brains. If you wish, the direction orthogonal to the screen are the uncompactified directions. And here, then we have some brains, and as we will discuss, these brains, which are perhaps located at some particular corner of the six-dimensional space, gives rise to standard model physics. And then there might be also other brains, which are called hidden sectors. Now the basic setup is the following. The first force in nature is gravity, right? And in quantized form, gravity is made by gravitons, and the gravitons are nothing else than closed strings. And closed strings, as they have no ends, they can propagate in the entire space. So these closed strings propagate through the entire 10-dimensional bulk space. So in 4 dimensions and also in the additional 6 dimensions. Second, we have gauge bosons like the gluons, non-abelian gauge bosons. And now these gauge bosons live as open strings on the lower dimensional brain. So the ends of the open strings are fixed on these brains. So the open strings can also, of course, propagate in 4-dimensional space-time and can propagate also partly on some internal cycles or submanifolds of the internal space. And finally, we have also so-called matter fields, the chiral fermions, and in some realization of the brain worlds or brain compactifications, these are open strings which live on the intersection points or intersection locus of brains in this internal space. I will show you this a little bit more in detail. So this is a basic setup which I will discuss. There are other ways to compactify string theory, but this is a framework I'm discussing here. And as it now turned out, and this is regarded as one of the problems, or perhaps also one of the virtues of string theory, depending on your personal point of view, it turned out that there's a large landscape of consistent deep brain compactification. There's not only one string solution, which is of this form, but there are many ways of choosing the internal space, and there are also many ways of, consistent ways in choosing these strings. And there, then the notion of this large landscape arose, and the question now clearly is, in spite of this big landscape of possibilities of string solutions, is there still a way to make some kind of model-independent predictions? Indeed, this will be possible, and to do it, I will now in the next slide basically focus only on this corner of the compactification, which is given by the brains, where the standard model of particle physics is located. So I make three basic assumptions to proceed. First, I consider deep brain compactifications which realize the standard model. So I throw away all the other compactifications which have nothing to do with the standard model. And this is a kind of reasonable assumption, because after all, I want to describe standard model physics. And to do it, there are now several ways, but basically it all boils down to choose a so-called local D-brain quiver of certain D-brains on which the degrees of freedom of the standard model are living on. And the simplest choice is that for each gauge group of the standard model, maybe I should have written down the gauge group of the standard model. I took it for granted that you know it, but maybe it's not the case. The standard model contains a group SU3, which corresponds to three D-brains, which is a group of the strong interaction of color, and here there are the gluons. Then there's another group in the standard model, which is SU2 for weak interaction, and this is a stack then of two different brains, and here the W bosons are living on. And then there's one more abelian group in the standard model, the group of the hypercharge, which we build out of some linear combination of U1s of single brains, as it is written here, or as it is shown here. So the photon somehow is an open string, which is a linear combination of here and here. And the matter fields, on the other hand, are fields which are living on the open strings, which are living on the intersection. So the left-handed quarks are open strings, which go from this SU3 stack to the SU2 stack, and so on. In this way, we could explain locally all the fields which appear in the standard model. One can even explain the generation pattern in case these D-brains intersect several times in the internal space. So this is my basic assumption, that I can embed this standard model quiver into the compact space. The next assumption I want to make is that I consider D-brain compactification, which allow for a low string scale. So I solve the hierarchy problem without supersymmetry. And in order for this to work, in principle, I have to make also some other assumptions about the internal space, which I will briefly mention. And then finally, I want to assume that perturbation theory is still valid, string perturbation theory, such that I can make reliable string computations when I will later on compute the cross sections of the fields in order to see what is the likelihood to discover these heavy excited string modes at the collider. There is perhaps one fourth assumption which I have to make. This is more technical, that the space which is orthogonal, which is longitudinal along the D-brains is unwarped. In other words, I get some additional hierarchies between masses, and I do not consider this case here. And now, it turns out, if I make these three or four basic assumptions, we will be able to extract universal predictions that are true for all points in the landscape, independent from any details of the compact space. And I think this is interesting, because in a way, in this way, we bypass the entire landscape problem. Of course, there are strong assumptions here. This assumption is reasonable, I would say, but of course, the main assumption is that we have string compactifications, working examples, which allow for low string scale. Yes? Well, I don't really believe that warping is generic. Of course, we have to consider the back reaction of the brains and so on. This assumption is rather mild. Basically, if you ask me, I need it to the. I assume that the Kaluza-Klein scale is a string scale, and therefore I assume unwarped spaces. If I assume warping, then there might be also a difference between the Kaluza-Klein scale and the string scale, which I will come now. But we can discuss about whether this is a strong assumption or not. Yes. Let me say the following. If you believe in the large number of possible string solutions, I'm pretty sure that one can realize these assumptions in a reasonable way, and not only that the set of solutions which satisfy the assumption is very small or even zero, but I personally believe that there are many string compactifications where I can make this assumption.
Think about large volumes, the generic situation may well be March work volume, which is a combination of March volume and March work volume.
Mm-hmm. Correct. So, in showing you this picture, I do not really want that these throats are too long here in this picture. This is one of my assumptions. This is a false assumption. So what are, under these assumptions, the three basic mass states in deep brain compactification? Yeah, Shamit?
This is just a data question.
Mm-hmm.
So, phenomenologists tell me that one of the big mysteries is that precision physics says the dimension six operators that can correct the standard model, instead of being TEV suppressed, they tend to be phi TEV suppressed.
Yeah,
Mm-hmm. Now, I would think that putting the power of strings at the TEV scale would be dramatically worse than putting a few technical rules at the TEV scale. So just without getting to any models, what is the constraint you can put on the string scale for precision?
Yeah, I come to this question at the very end. Of course, there will be some constraints or even very severe constraints. But in contrast to what I will discuss, all these constraints are model dependent. They depend also on global or discrete symmetries and so on, which I do not want to enter basically the discussion now about model dependent constraints. But on the other hand, what I'm telling you now, or I'm telling you today, is completely model independent. And therefore, I still believe that it makes use or it makes sense to discuss things in the way I do now. So what are the three basic mass scales in deep brain compactifications? The first, I told you already, is the string scale, which can be also written as 1 over square root of alpha prime, where alpha prime is nothing else than the slope parameter of the ratchet trajectory. The second scale, which we have already seen implicitly already, is the compactification scale, namely the inverse volume or the sixth square root of the inverse volume of the internal space, called M6. And then, since we have the submanifolds in the internal space around which the deep brains are wrapped, here there are a few examples. We have also submanifolds in the internal space with volumes Vp, which are not necessarily of the same order than the sixth dimensional overall volume. So there are new mass scales which are associated to the deep brains. Of course, if you make this split into longitudinal volumes and transversal volumes, crudely spoken, the product of Vp transversal and V longitudinal and V transversal basically again gives you the entire six-dimensional volume. Now we have these three, if you wish, dimensionful parameters, and we compare them with the three basic, with the two basic four-dimensional observables. The first four-dimensional observable is the force of gravity, parametrized in terms of the Planck mass. And now, if you express the Planck mass, the square of the Planck mass, in terms of the string scale in the internal six-dimensional volume, you get this basic relation, the 8 power of the string scale times the internal six-dimensional volume. And this product is fixed to be 10 to 19 GeV by experiment. Second, we have also, besides gravity, the gauge interactions. And in a similar way, if you reduce, if you do the dimensional reduction of the gauge theory, which lives on the wrapped brains, you will see that the effective gauge coupling constant, 1 over G square, like the coupling constant for QCD, is again given by a certain power, the piece power of the string scale, times the volume of the wrapped brains. And by experiment, here I'm a little bit crude, we know that these gauge coupling constants are not very big or not very tiny, they are of order 1. So I can use this relation to eliminate the parallel volume in terms of the string scale. And here I think warping also would become important. So these two, the comparison with experiment A and B, leaves one free parameter. And you can call it as you like. So I choose the string scale to be the free parameter in deep brain compactification. So from these two basic experiments, measuring the strength of the gauge interactions and measuring the strength of the gravitational interactions, the string scale is not forced to to be at the 10 to 19 GeV, it's a Planck scale, but it can be anywhere between 1 TeV, which is comes from experimental bound, of course, and the Planck scale itself. So if you're a little bit more specific, there are, if you wish, four natural scenarios or choices for the string scale. The first and the oldest one is that we identify the string scale with the Planck scale. Perhaps this is still the most reasonable guess where the string scale could be, but we should not be, I think, too much biased. So this is one of several options. Then, which is called the GATS scenario, the string scale is of the order of the scale where gauge coupling constant apparently unify, which is of the order of 10 to 16 GeV. And this is perhaps a favorite string scale for many people now who are looking at F-theory and to be oriented faults. I think it is reasonable if you really want to embed GATS theories right away into string theory. Third, this is the so-called Susie breaking scenario, which was in particular invested by Giocondo, Quevedo, and others, which I have already mentioned very briefly at the beginning. The strain scale is the scale where typically supersymmetry should break spontaneously in string theory. So around 10 to 11 GeV, because if you study something like gravity mediation, you get this very basic relation between the Susie scale, the string scale, and the Planck scale, and the standard model scale. And just to make a little advertisement of some papers we wrote recently, this can be, I think, also realized in the scenario what we have called domain wall supersymmetry breaking by fluxes. So this is already a somewhat lower string scale, but the most dramatic choice, as I have told you already, is that the string scale is the scale of the standard model of the order of 10 to 3 GeV. And one can now understand, I will even more commonly, that the effective scale of gravity, the Planck scale, is so high and gravity is so weak, since the gravitons, as the mediators of the gravitational force, can leak out of the four-dimensional space and can propagate into the six-dimensional bulk space, which is, in this case, of course, quite large. And this, we will see if we now use the string scale, plug it back into the formula which I have shown you before, which relates the Planck scale to the six-dimensional volume, now here expressed in terms of dimensionless numbers. These are the four choices which I have discussed. The one is where the string scale is the Planck scale, and the 10 to 32 is the case where it is a case of very large volume, where the string scale is of the order of TeV. So what we see here, and they even will comment that there's even a way out of this big number, but naturally you see that a low string scale implies a very large overall volume of the internal space. So let us proceed and see what kind of particles we have in this scenario. We have the string regular excitations, which I have mentioned already. These are the open string excitations. They are completely universal. They carry standard model quantum numbers, so they are charged under all the gauge interactions of the standard model. And they are the higher spin excitations of all the particles we know very well. Then, due to the compactification of the brains, we have the so-called Kaluza-Klein excitations. And these are the Kaluza-Klein excitations, which also are living on the D-brain. So they are, again, open strings. They now depend more on the details of the internal geometry. But once again, they carry standard model quantum numbers. So if you wish, these are the internal momentum excitations, again, of the standard model particles. And they're again charged under the standard model gauge interactions. So the string regular excitations and the D-brain, as we call them, D-brain cycle Kaluza-Klein modes, are charged under the standard model and have masses of order of the string scale. So they would be our main target, and we will ask the question, can they be seen at the LHC? There are further generic particles, and I like to mention the overall modulus, because if you do a string compactification, you can vary the volume of the overall space, and typically there's a volume modulus. And in some framework, you can even compute the mass of this corresponding scalar field. It is a closed string. It is neutral under the standard model. It interacts therefore only gravitationally, but you will see that the mass of this particle, of this scalar field, becomes very, very tiny if we do large volume compactifications. And this might be a further constraint, a further problem for this scenario, because there are many constraints on these very light particles. For example, from cosmology or from fifth force experiments. And if this particle would be really so light, I think it would rule out the whole scenario immediately. And therefore, one has to think about possible now radiative corrections to this mass. And without going into details, we made a short estimate about possible mass corrections to this neutral scalar field. They are similar to the corrections to the cosmological constant given by the two-point function of the energy momentum tensor. And then you see that you can expect something like 10 to minus 13 GeV, which is, so to say, at the edge of the experimental data, at least from fifth force experiments. So this non-standard model sector, which only acts gravitationally, gives you also further constraint on the scenario which I'm discussing. Finally, there are also these famous mini black holes, or string balls, also sometimes called. These are non-perturbative states, and they are now associated with a higher dimensional quantum gravity scale, which is also in this energy range of the string scale of 1 TeV. Again, one can estimate the mass of these non-perturbative black holes. They are suppressed by 1 over g string square, where g string is a string coupling constant. So if we see, if the string coupling constant is reasonably small, the masses of the black holes are heavier than the masses of the particles I am discussing. So in weakly coupled string theory, these gravity effects occur much above the string scale. For example, if you choose the string scale to be 1/10, and due to this equation, you will see that there are 10 to 4 string regio excitations before one reaches the first black hole. And therefore, I'm also discard these black holes from my discussion. And I think this is something which perhaps should be pointed out, because many people or colleagues, when they discuss models with a low scale of gravity, first think about these black hole production. I think that is not really correct, because the black holes will be produced much more later than the typical string excitations. Yes, which I told you is one of my assumptions. Right. So one more word about low string scale models. I think they fit very nicely, and then I come back to the LHC phenomenology. I think they fit very nicely into the general framework of the so-called large species models. And in this more general framework, one assumes a general quantum field theory which has n different species of particles. And already the standard model falls into the category, because already in the standard model we have of the order of 100 or so different particles. And now you can do a simple estimate. You can compute again the Planck scale in terms of the scale of gravity, and you will see, even at the perturbative level, that there's this factor n in between. So that if you are really strict, the Planck scale, when you have n particles, is not given in terms, it's not identical to the scale of gravity, but it is enhanced by this factor of n. And of course, this effect becomes very dramatic. If n is very huge, if n is, for example, 10 to 32, then we have precisely the effect what we want, namely that the scale of gravity is down by 16 orders of magnitudes compared to the Planck scale, namely at the 1 TeV. And one can also show that this relation arises from natural bounds on black hole decay. So it's really a completely universal model-independent relation. So if you look at this relation, you can say that the scale of gravity, the fundamental scale of gravity, m gravity, is a scale which is diluted, which is so it's lower than the Planck scale because it's diluted by the presence of the n particle species. And you can ask yourself, of course, then, is there a string realization of this large n species scenario? Yes, of course, there is the large volume compactification, which I have shown you before, is just a very concrete realization of this scenario, because now if you count not only the first Kaluza-Klein excitation, but if you count all Kaluza-Klein excitations, you will see that the number of Kaluza-Klein states with respect to the overall volume precisely matches up these numbers. So the number of Kaluza-Klein states are these states which provide this concrete realization of the large species model. And now you can also ask, what is the string realization of such a large number of Kaluza-Klein states? This was investigated by several people, not even in the context of very low scale models, but intermediate scales. These are the so-called Swiss cheese Calabiaus, and there are some additional requirements on the topology and on the geometry of the six-dimensional space, which I do not want to discuss further. But there are ways to realize this, as I think. There's even one, I think, interesting alternative to large volume compactification, which is perhaps not so well known. And these are super weakly coupled strings, because so far we used, so to say, the Kaluza-Klein modes to realize this high number of n. But suppose I want to play this game with internal space whose volume is of order one. Then the number n is the effective number now of string, really string excitation, string modes that contribute to this black hole bound. And what we did in the collaboration with Wally, we estimated the number n. It is a kind of effective number of string states, because these states are highly unstable. And it turns out, this comes also out from ADS-CFT considerations, that the effective number of degrees of freedom which contribute to this bound is just given by 1 over G string square. So if you choose the string scale, the string coupling constant, to be very, very tiny, then you get also the same kind of effect. You also lower the string scale by the same amount. And of course, this is not really a miracle, because if you put now both things together, the volume and the string coupling constant, you rediscover the well-known relation between the Planck mass and the string scale, which is of this form. So this was just a side remark. And now in the end of my time, I will discuss in a little bit more detail how we can test these deep brain models at the LHC. But maybe there are still questions before. Let me pause for a very short moment.
Is there any way, if you have such a small string coupling, is there any way to get reasonable gauge coupling?
Yes, I think so. Because then you have to invert the picture. You have you choose an internal manifold whose overall volume is of order one. But then you pick very extremely small internal cycles where you wrap the brains around. And if you use one of the relations I have shown you before, you again get a gauge coupling constant of order one. So instead of having a big Calabiau with order one cycles, now you have a small Calabiau with extremely small cycles inside.
Side. I think that
yeah, you might be right. So I assume that the volume now is of order of the string scale. I assume that V6 is of order one, and we can debate whether the formula is still valid or not. I assume that it's very, very tiny. Yes. 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 That is questionable because I think you can, but we can discuss it because as I think Joe Pochinski and others have told us, deep brains can probe much, much smaller scales than the string scale itself. So I'm entitled and I think I'm allowed to wrap deep brains on cycles which are much, much smaller than the typical string scale itself.
Well, I agree with that. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I can show you how the T-dual picture would look like. And it's not really the same picture as I was discussing before. It's an interesting question. Okay, other questions? So then let me come to the last part of my talk, namely the test of the D-brain models at the LHC. So here, for those of you who don't know how the LHC works, we are scattering two proton beams onto each other. The proton has partons, which are the quarks and the gluons. So effectively, we are considering the scattering of the partons of the gluons. So two gluons may scatter, two quarks may scatter, or also one quark and one gluon gives you the scattering process. If the energy is high enough, you produce new particles, which we call X. And these new particles, or any particle which is produced, then subsequently will decay into all possible standard model particles. And what you have to compute, basically, is this so-called parton model cross-section, sigma hat, and anything else is then given by gluonic or quark distribution functions, and so on. So what do we have in string perturbation theory? Let me just repeat for you. We have the redshift excitations of higher spin. And if I analyze the spectrum, the first resonances are the gluons, the excited gluons of spin 0, 1, and 2, and the excited quarks of spin 1 half and spin 3 half. It will be interesting to see that not all spin components couple to any of this scattering process, but this is a little bit more difficult to see. Then we have the Kaluza-Klein and possibly also Wining modes. And these are the two kind of states I like to consider. So now our aim is to compute the parton model cross-sections of the standard model fields into the new stringy states. And I will compute these cross-sections now, not in any effective field theory or using some phenomenological approach. I will compute these amplitudes directly in string theory using string techniques, because only in this case I can be sure that I get all the couplings in the correct way. So I will now really do an honest to God string computation to compute these scattering cross sections. So these stringy amplitudes, these string scattering amplitudes, exhibit some interesting properties, also interesting from the mathematical point of view. So perhaps if you start from some known QCD-like amplitudes, the Ernickel-Vorjang-Mills amplitudes, which were computed now recently by many people, the amplitudes we will consider add some more structure to it. Namely, they first contain also the quarks and the leptons in the fundamental representations. And from the conformal field theory point of view, which is my tool to compute these amplitudes, these fermions correspond to so-called boundary-changing twist operators, because, as I mentioned before, the fermions live at the intersection points of different brains. So we need, in conformal field theory, boundary-changing operators which change the boundary conditions of the open string from one brain A or from one brain stack A to another brain stack B. And as we will shortly discuss, there will be striking relations between the quark and the gluonic amplitudes, which can be also understood in some limit. And second, and this is perhaps even more important, they contain all stringy corrections. So if I look at a certain string amplitude, they always contain, of course, what we know from field theory, the field theory amplitudes among the light fields. But then they contain stringy corrections, and these stringy corrections are measured in terms of the slope parameter alpha prime. So this non-zero alpha prime, in a way, smoothes out the interaction and really describes the stringiness of the scattering process. So if we, on the other hand, take back alpha prime to zero, we will be left with the result which we know already from the standard model from field theory. So now, as it turns out, and this is basically the result what we got, and I will show you a few more details. If we are considering now some endpoint three amplitudes, so it's important that we consider three amplitudes, with zero or two open string fermions, maybe quarks or leptons, or n minus two gauge bosons, say gluons at the LHC, one can show that these amplitudes are completely model independent. They contain only the information about the string regispectrum. So they are insensitive to any details of the internal compact space. On the other hand, if you compute, if you consider amplitudes with more than two fermions, so for example the scattering of four quarks, then you can also excite the heavy Kaluza-Klein modes, and you get also some information about the internal geometry. So this can be also discussed in these pictures. So if we have an amplitude which only contains two quarks and n minus two gluons, this should be also small n here, then only the gluon or string regi modes can be excited. On the other hand, if we have four quark fields or more, you can also exchange Kaluza-Klein particles. And this is an important, I think, important distinction between various amplitudes, because if we have, so to say, in the incoming channel, as we discuss you, two gluons, if we scatter two gluons, and then observe in the final state channel, again, two gluons or two quarks, we can be sure that these amplitudes are not contaminated by any effect of the internal space. They are completely universal because they are given only in terms of string regi mode excitation. So let me show you this for the simplest case, n equals 4, four light external standard model fields. This is a so-called four-point disk amplitude with four string vertex operators. And in general, these amplitudes are now characterized by the following function and are dominated by the following pole. This was a picture I have shown you before, so I consider the scattering of this type of external open string states. First of all, we have, of course, the exchange of the standard model fields themselves. Then we have the exchange of the string regi resonances. And here, model some details which we can compute. Basically, we know the answer already from the year, I think it was 1967 or 68. Namely, it was told to us by Veneziano. We get Veneziano-like amplitudes. So we get an amplitude which depends on the four external particle momenta, and it depends also on the string scale or alpha prime. And the basic form is that these amplitudes are given in terms of these three gamma Euler gamma functions, where S, U, and T are the Mandelstam variables, which are these functions of the momentum. And now you can do something which is very useful. You can expand these amplitudes in terms of exchange particles. So in terms, say, in the S channel of poles in 1 over S minus the mass of the particles, the function gamma n are basically then the widths of these states, or the coupling functions of the n's particle to the standard model fields. And you get then, if you reorganize it, you get an expansion in order of alpha prime, powers of alpha prime, where the alpha prime now denotes the contribution of the stringiness, so denotes the contribution of the heavy excited string modes. And the same thing basically is written here, where I just have rescaled the momentum-dependent variables S, U, and T in this way. And then you see replacing, for example, alpha prime by 1 over the string scale, you get this expansion. So we will see sending alpha prime to 0, there will be basically one term which is left over, and this is a term already known from field theory. And, of course, if we have amplitudes with more fermions, as I have told you, you get also the exchange of the Kaluza-Klein in the winding modes. So let me show you this in one or two examples. I think I have 5 minutes, right? Yeah, okay, thanks. Let me show you first the simplest amplitude you can compute. It is a 4-gauge boson amplitude. So it is given in terms of a disk. There's a 4-gauge bosons are sitting here at the boundary of the worksheet disk. So you compute this amplitude in conformal field theory. You will see, and this shows what I have told you before in this example, that only the string resonances are exchanged. So the amplitude is completely model independent. And here I have written down two examples. The first example is the scattering of two gluons into two gluons. It is given by this combination where we have now summed over all ingoing spin degrees of freedom and so on. And you get a combination of these Veneziano-type functions, Vs, Vt, and Vu, with a momentum-dependent prefactor. And as I will discuss in a short moment, the experimental signature, the experimental signal will be given in terms of so-called digit events. You can do the test of sending alpha prime to zero, and then this entire amplitude collapses to this very simple expression, and you can open up some older textbooks, for example, Barger, and you will see that you get precisely this answer in the standard model, where all the fields of the standard model are included in this computation, because I use a complete stack of brains which realizes all standard model fields. There's another amplitude, two gluons into one gluon and one photon, for example. It is non-vanishing in string theory, but if you do the alpha prime to zero limit, you will see that, for example, this amplitude is not present at tree level in the standard model. So what is the experimental signature, in particular, of this two gluon into gluon scattering? Let me maybe omit this case because it goes rather in parallel to the previous one. This is the amplitude of two gauge bosons into two fermions. So if we now plug in all relevant numbers and estimate really the cross section at the LHC, then you will easily see, and this was of course expected, but now we have really the quantitative result, that these stringy corrections can be seen in so-called digit events at the LHC. So this is a plot which we made. We assume, for example, a 2 TeV first string excitation level. The width of the various particles can be computed in the model independent way. They just follow from the formula which I have shown you before. So depending on the spin of the particles, the width varies between, say, 15 and 150 GeV. And then you get several contributions from several heavy string modes. This is the standard model background, which can be computed, which can be, so to say, subtracted from our answer. And then you will see that there's a very clear signal much above the background, which should be easily seen if the string scale is really as low. And to convince you even further, one can compute a so-called signal-to-noise ratio now as a function of the string scale, with several luminosities, which hopefully can be reached at the LHC in some time. I think now it's realistic to have perhaps 100 inverse picobarn after some 2 years or so. And in any case, you will see that there is a clear signal-to-noise ratio, which tells you that I think 2 or 3 or even 4 TV string scale should be reachable in a finite amount of time. Okay. The four fermions on amplitude are also very interesting because now these contain for the first time the information about the Kaluza-Klein and the Wining resonances. We computed also in a now more toy-like model, because now you have to assume something about the internal geometry, the answer for this cross-section. It is given by several functions, and these functions now depend also on the internal geometry. So if you're interested, you can look it up in our papers. But again, it's a useful cross-check. If you do the alpha prime to zero limit, you get, again, the complete agreement with the standard model, with the known answer from the standard model. And you can also look at now poles in the U and T channel. Maybe time is a little bit short, so I leave out the details of the discussion now. And you can do also some plots. What is the likelihood also to see a Kaluza-Klein state at the LHC? And here, the situation is not as good as before because there's a lot of statistical uncertainty. You need much more luminosity. And to explain these figures, basically the blue and the other curve, hopefully it is red, the blue and the red curve is the difference between a cross-section with only regio modes and the addition of the first Kaluza-Klein, and you see that you need a lot of statistics to see the difference in these two curves. Yes?
7 or 14?
Excuse me?
7 or 14?
This is at 14, the sample calculation we did, so it's very optimistic. It's, I think, at 14 TeV, and we have to rescale it down also in case the energy is lower. That's correct. Okay, so the message here is also simple. In order to see the Kaluza-Klein modes, one needs a lot of energy and also high luminosity. We then also went on not only to compute 4-point but also 5-point amplitudes. Now these amplitudes depend on new kind of Veneziano functions, namely 2 here in this case. So if we have more external fields, we get more and more functions which resemble the alpha prime dependence of the string amplitude. And maybe I do not go into details now. You can again analyze these amplitudes. They are quite interesting. They contain a field theory piece and a stringy piece. And if we send alpha prime to zero, you get again something which is known from field theory, and it becomes more and more involved. The two characteristic functions basically correspond to the two ways now heavy string modes can be exchanged in a 5-point amplitude. So there are these two typical diagrams where the string mode, where there's first an intermediate light state, or there's a 4-point coupling like this. And these two functions, V and P, have different alpha prime expansions, so everything becomes more complicated. But we did it for 5 points, for example, also for 1 gluon and 4 quarks. So let me leave out all the details and jump right away to the conclusions. So what I like to tell you today in this talk for low string scale models, I think it is very clear that one can make, and this is for me the most perhaps important result, that one can make model independent predictions. And this was perhaps not expected before, because most people were believing that there are so many string solutions, and any string solution has a different signature at the LHC, say. But this is not true. One can really make model independent predictions. They are true for a large class of models in the string landscape, and these are precisely those processes with 2 or 4 gluons. And the big question, of course, then, where is the string scale? Is it really so low that this discussion can be applied? It is up to you. to believe it in a way or not. There are, of course, many other constraints, and presumably the likelihood for such a low string scale is small, but I think it is nevertheless worth to be investigated. So one can also try to get additional informations from the spin of the heavy mode, because you, experimentalists, of course, ask you how sure you are that you see a string excitation and not something else. And this can be decided, for example, by looking also at the spin. And this is also what we are doing, so some work in progress. So what we do now, in particular, we compute also the direct cross-section for the production of the heavy modes using, in technical terms, string vertex operators, not only for the light fields, but also for the heavy fields. And this is also interesting just for by itself to compute these amplitudes. This comes to Shamit's question. There will be many further constraints for model-dependent processes like flavor-changing neutral currents, and we also try to analyze this in a little bit more detail with Ralf and a student in Munich, whether certain processes rule out very low string scale. One question which is also often asked, what about gauge coupling unification? And it might be the case that there's a so-called mirage unification, that gauge couplings meet at a higher scale, or seemingly meet at a higher scale. I think this is related to something also Joe Conlon is doing. And of course, the big question is also, what is the cosmology of this low string scale model? Can one realize inflation or biogenesis or many other things which are relevant for cosmology? So I think it is fair to say, if nature chooses weakly coupled strings, if nature is, would be really so kind to us, if nature would be so kind to us to provide a string scale of a few TeV, then I think definitely the LHC should find it, and we will be able to analyze this. So thank you very much.
Correct.
If you have as external states gauge bosons, then you get model independent constraints, for example. But this is, I think it will not tell you too much, particularly for the LHC, because in the LHC we always have two gluons in the ingoing channel. And maybe you can, I showed you one process with the photons in the final state. And this is already a good test because it's not present in the standard model. On the other hand, if you have four fermion interactions, like flavor changing neutral currents or other high precision things, they are model dependent, because if you have four fermions or more, then you have already this contamination by Germany, by Kaluza clients. Well, I mean, ST and U are the mentor of the external states, but of course there can be also fermions. But I did not discuss. Sorry? Sure. That's something to be done, of course, to confront these things with these variables by terminologies like Peskin and so this STU and so on. So it is indeed some work which should be done, definitely. Correct. So I do not expect, of course, to see the entire tower. We will be able to see the first or second level. But I don't want to diminish these people's work, but the work which was mostly done or entirely done so far in the past is that people took some well-motivated effective field theory Lagrangian and computed the cross-section for these things. We wanted to be sure if we start really from string theory, what is the string outcome, and we saw that we do not have to tune any coupling, we do not have to choose any coupling, everything is model independent with respect to the 4-gauge boson or 2-gauge boson amplitude, and if you make some assumptions about the internal geometry, you get also you can also get results directly from string theory for Kaluza clients. But I did not want to say that these things were computed for the first time. I had, I think, also some. Sorry. No, I don't think so. I did not say anything about supersymmetry. Not necessarily. I don't need supersymmetry. I do not. Supersymmetry is also something highly. No. Please don't misunderstand me. I'm working with the superstring, but as you know very well, nobody can have supersymmetry. No, supersymmetry has to be broken in any case. And here I simply assume that supersymmetry could be broken by boundary conditions, which is, as you know, possible. The space-time spectrum not necessarily has to reflect supersymmetry because supersymmetry can be broken in various ways. But I'm, of course, discussing the superstring or the type 1 string, and if we would be in its critical dimension without compactification, it would be supersymmetric for sure.
Well, I think what he's alluding to, if you break supersymmetry by, not aligning special Lagrangian, then everything is body scaled by the slow end string scale. So you're going to
possibly yes, but let me repeat. I was so far only interested in really the model independent, and now you are asking me about the mass of. I'm not sure. I don't want to make wrong statements, but aren't. Don't there exist even models where the gravitino is projected out of the spectrum by some projection, like the O16 heterotic string in 10 dimensions? Of course, these models might not be the best models because they have various instabilities, but I think one can construct models in 10 and 4 dimensions where there is no superpartner of the graviton whatsoever at all in the spectrum. Yes. Correct.
Mm-hmm. So how much would
Yeah, that is also the question. Compare QCD with next to leading order QCD, and indeed we know the corrections are not perhaps not 100%, but they can be substantial. And it's a question just of this parameter, the string coupling constant, which did not really enter my tree-level results, because in a tree-level, I can always trade the string coupling constant in terms of gauge coupling constants. But if I now would start to compute loop corrections, then this issue you're asking becomes important. So indeed, I have to, and this was one of my assumptions, I assume that the string coupling constant is small in order to rely on these results.